I have a sad, rather tragic story to lay out to you this morning. In fact, it's a story of a tragedy within a tragedy. We've all seen the pictures, the very moving photographs in the papers, taken in those dust-ridden, barren plateau lands of northern Ethiopia, where famine is destroying life. Ethiopia, its leading novelist wrote some time ago, is God's way of putting an end to all things. It's an impossibly poor country today. The average income is $140 a year, the average lifespan, 46 years. It's a country which ought to be fertile. Life, in a sense, began in Ethiopia. It's where the great paleontologists have uncovered the earliest human ancestors. It was once a rich land of forests and high plateaus on which grain could be raised. But farmers abused the land, and their herds cropped the roots from the land that held the topsoil. Today, much of Ethiopia is a barren place. It's a place of periodic famine. It's a place where the end of an ancient feudal empire some 10 years ago has resulted in a very bitter, cruel tyranny by a Marxist-oriented junta, the Derga. In the last 10 years, it's estimated that 100,000 of the 34 million Ethiopians had died in revolutionary activity, fighting. 100,000 more died in the fighting between Ethiopia and Eritrea, Ethiopia and some of the rebels in the north. And 1 million Ethiopians have taken to on foot over the high plateaus and the mountains seeking escape, some kind of haven in the Sudan, Somalia, Kenya. And they subsist there in refugee camps on whatever food the world is prepared to survive, to provide. Now, this is the world in which the Falashas, the black Jews of Ethiopia, have more or less survived for the last several thousand years. They live in the Gondar region, in the high plateau of the north-central area, almost precisely in the heart of the area which has been most hit by the famine. They call themselves Beta Israel, the House of Israel. The word Falasha is a word in the local Guise dialect which means an alien or a stranger, and suggests that this people has been, in a sense, separate from those who consider themselves the main body of Ethiopia. Now, the Beta Israel believe that they derive from the biblical portion that I read to you this morning, the visit of the Queen of Sheba, traditionally Ethiopia, to King Solomon. They're a biblical people. They have the our Bible, deem it to be holy. And according to their tradition, their community began in that great visit by the Queen of Sheba to Solomon to test out his wisdom, in which he brought great wealth, spices and gold and jewels, and took back great wealth, spices and gold and jewels in exchange of gifts. And according to their tradition, she also took back a baby, Solomon's own, a man whom they call Memeluk. And Memeluk, Solomon sent with his son to Ethiopia a number of his courtiers. And according to the Falasha tradition, this group began the history of the Beta Israel. It gives them a sense of descent from nobility. Now, modern research suggests that this tradition is not quite historical. In point of fact, the Ethiopian Jewish community goes back only some 2,000 years, only some 2,000 years, to a time around the first century before the Common Era, the first century of the Common Era, when Judean traders dominated the commerce in the Red Sea and in the Gulf of Aden, a period of time when there actually was a Jewish kingdom in what is today Yemen. And they believed that at this time, Jewish traders established themselves all along the coast of the Horn of Africa, in Ethiopia, Somalia, Eritrea, and that the present Falashas are descendants of these people who came for commerce and trade, who also missionarized, and who also intermarried. And according to modern research, the Beta Israel lived along the coastland for some 400 years, until a dynasty arose in central Ethiopia, the Aksun, who were devoted to the Coptic Catholic Church, and gradually extended their authority. And of course, the most desirable land to possess is the coastlands. And they were able to defeat and dispossess the Beta Israel, who went on a long trek westward from the coast to the north central highlands, to the area where they have survived to this day. And there, in the Gondar region, the Beta Israel established their own kingdom. It was a powerful kingdom. At one time, it controlled a third of all the land mass of Ethiopia, which is a country the size of Texas. And they maintained their independence there for over 1,000 years, the longest-lived independent Jewish community in diaspora history. For the first 700 years or so, under their own kings and queens, they played a major role in Ethiopian feudal and tribal politics and war. And when a rebellion was finally successfully launched against the Aksum dynasty, it was troops of the Beta Israel, led by a queen by the name of Judith, who finally defeated the Aksum and overthrew this group. And then there was a period of several hundred years during which various groups in Ethiopia contested authority. And finally, another Coptic Christian dynasty gained power. And the Beta Israel found themselves caught between the expanding power of the Coptic Christians from the coastland westward and the expanding power of the Sudanese Muslims from the north southward. For several hundred years, they did the best they could in the 14th and 15th centuries to defend their independence. And then sometime around 1620, some historians give the date as 1616, others as 1625, the last independent king of the Beta Israel, a man by the name of Gideon, was defeated in battle, and the Falashas, the Beta Israel, lost their independence and lost their sovereignty. Many were sold into slavery. Many were simply killed as part of the defeat. The Beta Israel were forever forbidden to own land in Ethiopia. They survived since then on tenant farming, having to pay at least half of their crop to the Coptic landlords. And they were consigned to do the most menial of crafts that is allowed in that part of the world. They were the potters. They were the blacksmiths. And somehow or other, they survived in diminishing numbers. It's estimated there were between 250,000 and 500,000 Beta Israel in the 17th century. At the turn of our century, there were probably less than 60 or 70,000. Now, the Beta Israel were Jews. Researchers believe that these people brought with them in the first century or so a Judaism which had not yet been completely transformed from its biblical base into its rabbinic form. And so although they have the Bible, as we have it, and although they have some of the books of the Apocrypha, the book of Maccabees, the book of Tobit, of Judith, the book of the Maccabees, they do not have the Talmud, although they practice some of the rules of the rabbinic tradition. Their religious life is governed by a set of priests known as Kahin. The priesthood is, however, not hereditary. It is a priesthood of election. Every village and hamlet of the Beta Israel has a central round wattle and straw hut, which is their synagogue. The hut is divided in two, usually by a central wall. It's not a separation between men and women, But like the temple in Jerusalem, it's a separation between the front court and the Holy of Holies. And in the Holy of Holies, they keep their folio copy of the scripture. They did not have until recent times the Torah as we have it. They had only a scripture in Ethiopic translation in Ge'ez. They seem to have lost the ability to speak and read Hebrew sometime in the 15th or 16th century. They are very much concerned with the laws of ritual purity, which were very important in biblical times. Well, those who carry a corpse to its grave must wash themselves in the river before they can re-enter the village. A woman during her menstrual period must go to a hut outside the village and remain there for that period of time. A woman in childbirth must live in a hut specially constructed for her for almost a month until she's allowed back with her child into the village. A falasha, a Beta Israel, who leaves his village where there are these laws of purity and of dietary rules and who goes to the city, is not allowed to come back to the village. He is impure unless he engages or she engages in a very long, complicated rite of purification. They have rites which are not known generally among Jews. There are monks among the Beta Israel, people who devoted their lives to religious life, who lived apart from the community in devotion and in practice. And in their synagogues, there is usually still a stone altar, indicating that until sometime in the recent past, some of the biblical sacrifices were still offered. The only sacrifice which they offer to our day is the Paschal sacrifice, the lamb on Passover. Now, there's never been any real question that the Beta Israel are Jews. They were not known during the Dark Ages, but beginning with the Middle Ages, Jewish travelers occasionally penetrated into the fastness of central Ethiopia. Benjamin of Tudela and others brought back reports of the Beta Israel, whom they called descendants of one of the lost 10 tribes of the tribe of Dan. And the Jews of Europe who heard about these strange people on the other side of the world believed that when they would return and capture Jerusalem, the Messianic age would truly be at hand. And indeed, the Beta Israel are very messianically oriented people. They believe deeply that there will come a time when the Messiah will come about, when all evil people will be destroyed, while they will be led in glory to Jerusalem. In the 16th century, we find a rabbi in Egypt, a man by the name of David ben Salomon ibn Zimra, one of the great halachic leaders of the time, being asked by Egyptian Jews whether or not it's permitted to intermarry with the falasha, and whether the descendant of a child of such a marriage would in fact be acceptable, fully acceptable in the Jewish community. And he answered without equivocation that yes, they are Jews, and although they have some practices which are not similar to those of the Egyptian Jewish community, intermarriage is possible and the children would be fully accepted within the community. After the destruction loss of independence in 1620, very little is heard about the Beta Israel until the 19th century. These were difficult times for them. They were cut off from Europe by the defeat of the African peoples, and they were certainly consigned to legendary history. And then in the 19th century, as Western missionaries began to move into the fastness of Central Africa, Portuguese and Dutch missionaries discovered the Beta Israel, and they believed that here was a fertile field to fish for souls. And in fact, because of their impoverishment and because they were offered education, the opportunity to come to the city, many were enticed to accept Christianity. But in 1862, a Portuguese missionary, frustrated in his efforts, organized a pogrom by the local peoples against the Beta Israel. And in 1867, a group of over 1,000 of them began a long trek on foot from central Ethiopia up into the Sudan, up into lower Egypt, seeking to come to the Holy Land. They were, in a sense, the first to attempt a Zionist immigration, a Zionist aliyah. They didn't get as far as Palestine. The trek was dangerous. They were attacked by robbers. They were attacked by wild animals. Most of them died on the way. And a few finally made it back, having gone some 2,000 miles and more on foot in their attempts to get to Jerusalem. Somehow, knowledge of this attempted exodus reached Europe, and the Jewish Community Federation of France, known as the Alliance Israélite Universelle, sent a professor of the Sorbonne, we would call him today a professor of sociology and anthropology, a man named Joseph Halevi, sent this gentleman to Ethiopia to make contact with the Beta Israel to see what he could find about them and to bring back a report about what needs they might have. He was very much moved by what he found. He portrayed himself as a white Falasha, a white Beta Israel. And when he went to the first village and had gone through a rite of purification to allow him to enter the village chief, finally understanding that he was saying, essentially, I'm a Jew, as you are Jews, said to him, now I know the world isn't as bad as I thought it was. There are other Jews out there. In any case, he discovered a good bit of the tradition of the Falasha. He was able to write a long report to the Alliance of their needs. They needed medical care. They needed nutritional help. They needed teachers, schooling, particularly vocational education. They had been cut off in the central highlands from all civilization for many centuries. And Halevi went back to Paris and presented his report to the Alliance, and it was shelved. Nothing was done. Why not? Well, this is now 1870. One assumes that these bourgeois sense the growth of a new racist anti-Semitism in Europe. This is the group in France which most desperately wanted to be considered Frenchmen above all else. Black Africa was still considered the lesser breeds without the law, and the last thing they wanted to keep before the French population was the put before the French population was the idea that some Jews were in fact primitive peasants, tenant farmers, scrubbing a bare living off the land in darkest Africa. In any case, nothing was done. And the only result of this trip was that one of the students of Halevi, a man named Joseph Feklovich, a Jew from Lodz in Poland who was studying at the Sorbonne, was encouraged to make a trip, which he did in 1905, to the Falasha, to the Beta Israel. And he was so moved by what he saw that he not only brought back another report of their needs, which he tried desperately to sell to the Hilfsverein, the Jewish Federation of Germany, the Alliance, the Jewish Federation of France, the Board of Deputies, the Jewish Federation of England, totally without response or success. So much so that he created in various communities where he had friends and people who were sympathetic to his concerns a series of what they called pro-Falasha communities, who from about 1910 on began to send money. Occasionally a teacher could be induced to go for a year or two to the Beta Israel villages, and he at least kept knowledge of the Falashas of the Beta Israel before the conscience of world Jewry. But very little else happened, and very little else would happen for many, many years. One would have supposed that with the establishment of the State of Israel, in 1948, the plight and fate of the Falashas would begin to become a matter of concern to the agenda of world Jewry and to the agenda of the new state. After all, it was only 2.5 years later that the famous magic carpet operation was begun, which brought out from the Yemen, just across the Gulf of Aden from Ethiopia, almost the entire ancient Yemenite Jewish community. But in point of fact, despite the law of return, which said, in effect, that anyone who was a Jew was allowed to return to Israel, and despite the fact that Israel was then led by Ben-Gurion, whose Zionism required what he called the Shlilut HaGolah, the ingathering of all of the exiles, despite the fact that the bringing to Palestine, to Israel, of the Jewish communities of the world was believed to be a major item on the agenda of the early governments, not a move was taken to bring in the Falashas to Israel. Quite the reverse. During those years of the 50s and the 60s, Israel and the Jewish Agency occasionally sent people to the villages of the Beit HaYisrael, teachers, doctors, people of one kind or another who could be useful, trying to support their what there was of their economy and their life there, in a sense to keep them at a distance so that they might not be moved to try and pressure Israel to bring them in. Now, it was during those years that an American Association for Ethiopian Jewry came into being. And when protests were made to the Israeli government and to the Federation movement in the United States that there must be some kind of urgent concern for this people who were strangers in their own land, looked down upon, unable to earn a living, unable really to survive, whose community was diminished and was diminishing, the Israelis tended to respond, and the leaders of our own Jewish community tended to respond by saying that we're doing all that we can, that quiet negotiations are taking place, and there are reasons of state why these negotiations must be done quietly. Of course, there was another side to all of this. Golda Meir is reported to have said when she was approached by some of these people with who were concerned with the fate of the Beit HaYisrael, they'd be awfully uncomfortable here. They'd be subject to prejudice. And another one of the leaders of the government at the time said they'd be like fish out of water in Israel. There is racism in our community, as in all communities, and I think it's important that we at least acknowledge it. Now, why did Israel not move to try diplomatically to find a way to bring the Falashas, the Beit HaYisrael, to the Holy Land? The answer, I suspect, lies largely in the needs of the new state to try and break out of the economic blockade which the Arab world had put about Israel, which was designed to try and cut off the third world from Israel so that Israel could not send its people and its commerce and its trade into that world. When the Italians had attacked Ethiopia in the 1930s and had conquered the country, Haile Selassie, the little emperor of Ethiopia, had gone into exile. His first place of exile had been in Jerusalem. A number of his princes and princesses had remained in Jerusalem throughout the war. And once Israel was established, Ethiopia, by and large, maintained a kind of benevolent neutrality as far as Israel is concerned. She did not fully break relationships. There was an Ethiopian interest section in Jerusalem, and in 1956, they allowed Israel to open an embassy in Addis Ababa. There was a good deal of trade between the two countries. Ethiopia was particularly interested in having Israel send agricultural experts, irrigation experts, engineers who could help them with their plans for developing their cities and their infrastructure. In fact, a very interesting relationship developed in those years between the University of Haifa and the University of Addis Ababa, in which the men from Haifa came down and established a school for agronomy in Addis Ababa for the sake of the development of the Ethiopian economy. To the Israelis, Ethiopia was the diving board which would allow them to jump into sub-Sahara Africa, into Kenya and Uganda and Tanganyika and Zimbabwe and these other countries and establish relationships of trade and of commerce and of diplomatic relationships which will allow them to have a toehold, an important economic and political toehold in the Third World. And unfortunately, as the Israelis looked at it, the Beit HaYisrael stood in the way of this kind of arrangement. Why? Because Haile Selassie, which means Holy Trinity, was a fervent Copt. The Copt looked down upon the Jews. The Jews were, these Falashas were treated as third or fourth class citizens, if they were citizens at all. And to have, Israel apparently believed that to have encouraged the Haile Selassie's government to think of Israel in terms, the same terms as they were thinking of the Beit HaYisrael, the Falashas, would have been to weaken their efforts to establish strong and permanent relations with Addis Ababa and that government. And so the tragedy of the Beit Israel continued. The need was there, and the leadership of Israel and of the world community, in a sense, entered into a conspiracy of silence and did not respond to that need. And though it was put out by successive governments in Israel that secret and complicated negotiations were taking place, in fact, it has been revealed since that no negotiations ever took place between the Israeli government and the government of Ethiopia. And that's the condition as it came down into the 1970s. In Israel, the governments hid, in a sense, behind a religious problem. They claimed that it was not clear that the Beit Israel were in fact Jews, despite the fact that as early an authority as a 16th century rabbi, Ibn Zimra, had declared them to be Jews, despite the fact that two of the great halachic authorities of the 19th century, rabbis Hildesheimer and Rhinus, had declared them to be Jews, despite the fact that the chief rabbi of Palestine in the 1920s, Rabbi Cook, had declared them to be Jews in all respect, the Israeli government put out, and the religious parties in Israel tended to sympathize with this position, that the final judgment had not yet been made, and that therefore the concept of the ingathering of the exiles did not really reach out and include the Beit Israel. It was not until 1972 that sufficient pressure was brought on the Sephardic chief rabbi to declare the Falashas to be, in effect, Jews, and not for another 3 years before the chief Ashkenazic rabbi was willing to add his name to that decision. Now the Israelis, by the Beit Israel, by the early part of the 70s, are declared to be Jews. There ought to be concern for them, and that concern comes too late. Because in 1974, the government of the octogenarian Haile Selassie is overthrown. The Derga, which is Marxist in its orientation, pro-Soviet, comes into power. The Israelis are thrown out of Addis Ababa and told to pack up and go home. And there's now no ability of anyone to negotiate for the release of the Beit Israel. And what we have now is a period of where Ethiopia becomes a killing ground between the various factions in the country. And everyone who passes through the territory of the Beit Israel takes a whack or two at them. Their numbers are diminished. 1 million Ethiopians walk into exile, and any number of Beit Israel go into exile with them. But the countries of the displaced persons camps are all Muslim countries. And so now, in countries which Israel has no relationships, it's almost impossible to get to these people who have come out, and they continue to suffer even when they are outside of Ethiopia. When Menachem Begin comes to power in the late 1970s, he becomes the first prime minister of Israel who takes an active and affirmative interest in the Beit Israel. And he orders the establishment of absorption centers for their particular needs. He sends members of the Shin Bet and the various Israeli intelligence agencies into these surrounding countries to see if they can't discover where the Falashas are and bring them out. And over a period of a dozen or so years, about 7,000 of the Falasha have come out and have been brought to Israel. There are now 23 absorption centers in Israel where attempts are being made to help them acclimatize themselves to an entirely new and quite obviously quite different environment. But even so, the tragedy of the Beit Israel continues. The long years of frustration have led to a condition in which those who championed the cause of the Beit Israel over the decades no longer believe the state of Israel, no longer believe anything they say about the Beit Israel. And there are, of course, radical Jews who are eager to paint Israel as a racist state, who begin to use the Beit Israel as proof of Israel's racism. And there are those who have been the most concerned about the Beit Israel cannot believe that under Begin things have in fact changed. And so they begin to circulate among those who have come out names of people they claim are in the displaced persons camps in various parts of the country, whom they claim the Israelis are not trying to save. These lists have been shown to be partially true, largely untrue. It's very hard to be sure as to their complete accuracy or inaccuracy. And they are busy, in a sense, out of their concern for those who survive, who will remain, that they're stirring up and continue to stir up the fears, the anxieties of those Beit Israel who have come out, who are usually the young, who have left families behind. There are almost no complete families. Tremendous sense of guilt of having left one's family behind. And they're now caught between a government which says we are doing all that can be done, pressure groups which say you can't trust what the government is saying to you, and their own fears and concerns, and the fact that they are, in fact, a minority in a land in which racial prejudice is not unknown. The Israel has long been accustomed to think of the blacks as the black Hebrews of Chicago and Dimona, groups of non-Jews of various kinds who came to Israel, established all little communities here or there, refused to abide by Israeli law, refused to have even the basic hygienic rules followed. They see color, they don't see the difference. And there has been really no attempt made as yet to educate the Israeli children, the Israeli population, as to the history and the culture and the background of the Beit Israel. Kind of situation which arises was recently highlighted by the visit to Ethiopia of one of the secretaries of state of the Foreign Ministry of Great Britain, a Jew by the name of Jeremy Rifkin. About a year and a half ago, Rifkin was in Addis Ababa, and he raised the question of the Falashas who remain. There's supposed to be 20 and 25,000 of them in these hamlets and towns. And he came out saying that he was assured by the government that, in fact, it was now possible to think of mass immigration out. The Israelis say, we immediately contacted the Ethiopians, and there is no change in their policy. The Ethiopian government does not permit anyone who is not on a government mission to leave the country. The American Association for Ethiopian Jewry says you can't trust the government. They did not, in fact, make these contacts, and the poor Beit Israel, the 7,000 who have made it to Israel, don't know whom to believe, and are really pawns in a war between two contesting groups of so-called fellow Jews. Where are we now? The history of the Beit Israel is about to end. Even if the 20,000 or so who remain in Ethiopia are able to come out, there'll be a small minority. Their history is behind them. In Israel, they will have to, in one way or another, assimilate to modern culture and modern attitudes. And one of the tragedies of their absorption into Israel is that the Israeli religious groups have determined that they must make these people over into the very model of men and women from the Turei Karta, from the most Orthodox groups in Israel. They've made attempts to dress them up as Eastern European Jews and to force them into accepting these kinds of habits and customs. There's been very little attempt until quite recently simply to let the Beit Israel come, live, be absorbed, find their own way, help them with vocational skills, but allow them to retain their sense of family and their sense of culture. And the community itself, the larger community, has not yet really come to grips with its own guilt in this sad history and its own racism, which runs through this whole story. Because truth be told, one of the reasons that the Jews of Yemen were saved and the Falashas were not, the Jews of Yemen were Semites, they were brown, they were not black. Blackness somehow still is a sign of difference, of inferiority, a of being a lesser breed without the law. Attempts are being made, I firmly believe now, to make amends for the past. But those who have come to Israel have come at a time of economic stringency, where there are few jobs, great and growing unemployment. It's difficult for them to find, having the minimal skills that they do, any kind of meaningful employment. Therefore, their pay levels are low. The standard of living is necessarily low. They can afford few of the amenities. They come to Israel at a time when there are these competing groups who are trying really to manipulate them, each to their own advantage and benefit, for other reasons than their own needs. And the best one can say is that the last several years they have begun to draw together and to coalesce. And there is now an association of Ethiopic Jews, of Falasha's, for Falasha interests, who are beginning to come together to fight their own fights and to make their own way in Israel and to see that the Israeli government responds to some of their own needs, the most pressing of which is to bring their own families out if possible and to join with the community there. Where are the Falasha? Where are the Beit Israel? Some 20,000 are probably still in the highlands of Ethiopia. Some of these are in those pitiful camps that you've seen in the paper where people are begging for food. Some of them are walking the few hundred miles, taking the long trek across the plateau in the mountains to the camps just outside the Ethiopian border. There, some of them have been attacked by Muslims, who after all control this area. Others have been sold into slavery in the Sudan, into various households. Some are ultimately able to be brought out. About 1,400 of them were able to make their way to Israel last year. In Israel, their fate is considerably better than it once was. The government, including this present government, seems to be showing concern for their needs. The Department of Immigration seems for the first time to be sensitive to their needs. The community relations agencies in the United States have finally begun to deal with the Beit Israel problem and to begin to add its concerns and its pressures to those of those who were concerned all along. And those who are in Israel are trying to adjust to a society. A few have been there 20 or 30 years, have already acclimatized themselves. But the diet is different, the language is different, the skills required to make a living are different, the family structures are different. In the absorption centers, for instance, they discovered that though in all other absorption centers you could have the children and the adults in the same Hebrew class, you couldn't with the Beit Israel. Because age is a sign of knowledge and venerability, and for an elder to sit with a child in the class was to destroy every one of the his whole sense of honor and dignity, his relationship with the child. And so they've had to create separate classes for the various age groups. It's a sad story, isn't it? It's a story which reminds us that sometimes we, our own people, can be as indifferent to our people as the rest of the world, in fact, can be. And that we ought not to look always at them as a source of our problems, that some of them are of our own creation. I don't know if Israel could have brought out the Beit Israel, the 40,000 or so, 50,000 perhaps, who were there in the late 40s and early 50s, but I know they didn't try. I don't know what will happen to the 7,000, whether it will grow to 10 or to 15 or even to 20,000 over the next years in Israel. But I hope and pray that our people will show the rachmonis and the wisdom, which we claim as our basic virtues, in our relationships with them, and in part make up for the sins of the past. Amen.
Thank you.
Let us adore the ever-living God and render praise unto him who spread out the heavens and established the earth, whose glory is revealed in the heavens above and whose greatness is manifest throughout the world. He is our God, there is none else. We bow the head in reverence and worship the King of Kings, the Holy One, praised be he. Ba'anachnu kori'im u'mishtachavim u'modim lifnei melech malachei hamalachim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu.